I also want to thank the organizers for setting up this nice conference and for giving me the opportunity to speak here. The topic of my talk is gauge invariant coherent states for loop quantum gravity, and this is part of my PhD thesis under the supervision of Thomas Thiemann at the Albert Einstein Institute. And I would start with the motivation, why coherent states, semi-classical states, and in particular gauge invariant coherent states are useful. I will talk about the complexifier coherent states that have been used so far, and why one would like to have gauge invariant ones. I will talk about these gauge invariant coherent states. I will give a definition for them and talk about their properties and try to convince you that they have equally nice properties that the complexifier coherent states themselves have. And yes, close with a summary and an outlook. Okay, as we have already heard, loop quantum gravity kinematics is set up on a kinematical Hilbert space, and on this Hilbert space there are several constraints, the Gauss constraint, the diffeomorphism, and the Hamilton constraint, which can be combined into the Master constraint, as we have heard in the previous talk and this morning. And physical states are the ones that are supposed to be annihilated by all these constraints. And the problem is that this is very difficult to solve, as we have, Tina has just said in her talk, and one would like to have a tool for probably have an approximate sense of being a physical state. Another point, and a very important issue, is, but which we also have heard in the last talk, is the one, does this kinematical setup have the right semi-classical limit? And one very good tool for addressing these questions are coherent states or semi-classical states. And the candidates that are usually used are the complexifier coherent states that have been investigated by Thiemann and Winkler in the beginning of the century. The definition is fairly general, although I'm afraid I can't show you the definition because... Is there something going on? Okay, thank you. Okay, the definition is as follows. These states are labeled by a classical connection and a classical electric flux, that is a classical point in classical phase space, and is depending on this operator, which is called a complexifier, and by choice of a nice operator, by choice of a nice complexifier, you get nice complexifier coherent states. And the simplest example of these states is the one where you choose the complexifier on a set graph, living in the three-dimensional spatial manifold, such that on each edge of the graph, this is basically the Laplacian operator, and this gives you states that live in the special Hilbert space corresponding to that graph, and that are labeled by the complexified holonomies along these edges, and this parameter T, which is basically gives you the semi-classicality scale. Well, why complexified holonomies? Well, think of the harmonic oscillator coherent states. These depend on a complex number, Z, which is basically the complex combination of configuration and momentum variable, Q plus IP. And this is basically the holonomy along that edge in a complexified version such to also incorporate the electric flux. Okay, so this is basically the phase space, the cut-through phase space if you restrict the degrees of freedom of general relativity to this one set graph. Okay, and for G equals SU2, as a gauge group, you can write them down. They have this nice formula. They are product state, product over each edge. And the labeling set is basically a number of, if this graph has E edges, is a set of E elements of the complexification of SU2, which is SL2C. As I said, which is thought to be as a point in classical phase space. They have very nice properties. The first of them is the so-called Peakness property, which means that, as well as, for instance, the harmonic oscillator coherent states, that the overlap between two such states is pretty nearly one if the two labeling sets, the two points in classical phase space, coincide, and is pretty nearly zero if they don't coincide. And this pretty nearly is basically ruled by this parameter T. So this overlap is basically a Gaussian in some kind of distance function between these two elements, and we have seen some plots in, for instance, in Tina's talk or in Thomas Thiemann's talk this morning about this nice Gaussian overlap function. Another property is the so-called Ehrenfest properties, that is the expectation value of certain operators in these states and these operators being quantizations of classical phase-space function, is basically the evaluation of that classical phase-space function at that phase-space point, where approximately here and approximately there means basically up to orders of this t. So if t gets smaller, you can think of this state as becoming more and more the classical phase-space point given by this letter g. And especially with the last property, what Tina has talked about, is that one can show that the mass are constrained and all the other constraints are implemented correctly. In particular, you can see that these states are somehow close to satisfying the constraints. Okay, so these are nice properties, but the problems with these states are that they do not satisfy the constraints at all. Only in an approximate sense, I can somehow choose them to be peaked on points in the constraint hypersurface, but still they are not aware of the constraints. They are purely kinematical states. And one would like to have, as we've already heard, is that coherent states that satisfy the constraints in order to address really points in the physical phase space of general relativity. Okay, and in this talk, I will, as a zero order step or first order step, show you the constructions of states that at among these satisfy the Gauss constraint and try to convince you that these gauge invariant coherent states have equally nice properties as the complexifier ones. Okay, the Gauss gauge group acts basically as follows. Think of a graph being embedded in the spatial manifold with E edges and V vertices. Then the Gauss constraints basically act as a gauge group on each vertex. That is, you have a function psi depending on E holonomies along the E edges, and the transformed function, basically the old function, depending on the sandwich holonomy, where B of E1 is the beginning point of E1, this is the final point of E1, and this is basically what you also know from lattice gauge theory. And if the gauge group G is compact, which in the case of SU2 or U1 cubed or whatever you'd like to do is, then you can basically integrate over it and obtain this map as an operator from this kinematical part of the Hilbert space to the gauge invariant one. Okay, so now let's talk about these gauge invariant coherent states. They are basically obtained by taking the old complexifier coherent states and just brutally projecting them onto the gauge invariant Hilbert space. And they are again labeled by this semiclassical electric parameter T. But they are also labeled by this G, but not really by this G, but only by sort of equivalence classes of this G. So one can show that these states with different G and G prime are the same if the corresponding set of SL2C elements can be related by a complexified gauge transformation. So this is exactly the same formula as before, just that now the gauge transformation relating these two elements can also be an SL2C element. Or if you have an arbitrary gauge group like the complexified gauge group. So these are L2 functions on this space, like GE modulo the gauge actions. This is the space of orbits. And they are labeled by equivalence classes, which are basically, you think of them as SL2C elements, modulo these SL2C gauge transformations. And if you compute the dimensions of these, you immediately see that this is the configuration space. This is the set of points where the functions depend on, and this somehow is exactly twice the number of degrees of freedom, which means that, see, this is configuration and this is configuration plus momentum. So this has the right, this can be thought of as being a point in gauge invariant phase space. Also note that these things, if G is an abelian gauge group, this again is G to the E minus V plus 1 or so, but if this is not a non-abelian gauge group, then this is not a real manifold at all. It has singular points as well as this space. And we will see what kind of implications this later has when we consider SU2 as a gauge group. First, we're going to show a simple example. In particular, if you choose the gauge group to be U1, then you can write down the complexifier coherent states immediately. They have this nice formula. Depending on these E faces and the E complexified phases, along the edges, and one can show that the gauge invariant coherent states basically have this apart from this factor, this is the number of vertices, this is the number of maximal trees in the graph. This is basically looking nearly the same. This depends on certain gauge invariant combinations of the phases, certain gauge invariant combinations of the complexified phases. which you also have to choose according to some certain graph theoretical considerations. So this is really nearly a complexifier coherent state on U1 to the E minus D plus 1, which is also the number of degrees of freedom for abelian lattice gauge theory. So this is really nice, and this shows you that for abelian gauge groups, this immediately works and gives a really cool result. Coming to SU2 is a bit more complicated, and that's what I'm going to spend the rest of the talk on. So for gauge invariant coherent states on a graph gamma, you again choose the gauge invariant coherent state as being the projection of the complexifier coherent state, now with these being real SL2C elements. So this function, this complexifier coherent state, depends on, you can think of this as the gauge variant configuration space, the gauge variant phase space, and this space depending on the gauge invariant configuration space being labeled with points in the gauge invariant phase space. And one can compute these states, and this has also been done by Thiemann and Winkler, and they have this a bit inaccessible form, because, I mean, these are the basis functions depending on the labeling rates and upon the intertwiners of the graph. It's with this explicit form that one can now try to see whether these states have the nice properties. For instance, the simplest graph that one considers, the so-called one-flower graph, is just one vertex and one edge starting and ending at that graph. And one can immediately compute these states, this gauge invariant coherent states, depending only, I mean, if you consider 2x2 matrices modulo conjugations, the only invariant information is given by the trace. And this trace can be neatly parameterized by these complex numbers, by the arcus cosine of half of the trace of these elements. And you can simply write down the overlap functions between, say, two gauge invariant coherent states, and you can, up to orders, up to corrections in T, really compute these and, well, just plot them. And what you see is exactly what you would like to see. We have now the overlap between these coherent states, one of them labeled with this complex number W, one of them labeled with the complex number Z, W being fixed and Z running through. And W is being taken as 1 plus I, which is somewhere around here, what you would like to see. And of course, since this description, this labeling is symmetric via Z goes to minus Z, then of course you have these two peaks. So this is really nice. What is a bit astonishing is the fact that if you choose W to be not 1 plus I, but say 0, like laying in the center, you get the following picture. The overlap function is not a real Gaussian anymore. In fact, you can see this strange plateau structure here, and if you look at this as a profile, you can really see that this is an e to the minus x to the 4 over t or so. This is not a Gaussian, this is something flatter. But still, it is peaked around that point. Okay, so this is the one flower graph. Unfortunately, for other graphs, it's a bit difficult to do the same thing analytically, just due to the complicated structure of the intertwiner spaces with the associated with the complicated graph. But what you can do is one can at least look at some graphs numerically and see whether these nice results hold as well. And we've done this for the two-flower graph, for the sunset graph, and partly also for the tetrahedron graph. And the qualitative results always stay the same. And I will just demonstrate this with an example of the sunset graph. Two vertices and three edges starting at one and ending at the other one. And the gauge invariant phase space is the equivalence class of three elements of SL2C. SL2C, two vertices and three edges. And after a suitable procedure of gauge fixing, this corresponds to three complex parameters, which I chose to be arcus cosine of the trace of G2 and G3 and some kind of complex angle between these two. And so this is the labeling set where the gauge invariant coherent states on this graph are peaked, are labeled. That they are peaked is what's been shown in this picture. So you can immediately see W2, W3, and chi is where one of these states is labeled, and the other labels are, for instance, Z2 and Z3 are running through. And you can immediately see that the same nice Gaussian picture. It's a bit shifted, it's a bit squeezed, if you'd like. But basically, it's the same nice Gaussian picture. Again, if we choose these sets to be exactly zero, we see again this strange plateau structure that we have. And what does it mean? This means that W2, W3, and chi being zero means that this is the equivalence class of G1, G2, G3, where all the Gs are equal to the unit element in SO2C. And in fact, as I told you, the manifold, the space of the gauge invariant phase space is not a manifold, but it has some singular points, and exactly this is a singular point of this manifold. You see that gauge invariant gradient space, states that are labeled on these degenerate points have some kind of, well, stranger structure of the overlap. But they're still peaked around these points. Okay, and you can show these as a general property. In all the examples, the gauge invariant coherent states are really peaked around the gauge invariant data. And in all the examples, we've also seen that states with the data is corresponding to degenerate gauge orbits, for instance, like all of them being to one, have significantly a broader peak. Well, not really broader, but we have this plateau structure. This is not a clean Gaussian anymore, but, well, has a stranger shape. And in fact, one can show this analytically at the maximum of the peak. All derivatives vanish until the order of four. So this is really is no Gaussian, but as I said, it's flatter. You can show this in general for flower graphs, and you can show this in the t equals to zero limit for general graphs. But you've seen this in for finite t already for the sunset graph. So the fact that the proof of this only works in the t goes to zero limit due to the really complicated structure of these states, we think that this also holds for general graphs. It's just much, much more difficult to show. Okay, so let me summarize. The gauge invariant coherent states for the U1 or the SU2 gauge group have been obtained by projecting the complexifier coherent states to the gauge invariant subspace, and they have been investigated numerically and analytically. And in both gauge groups, you see that the gauge invariant coherent states behave semi-classically. That is, the overlap is peaked around the gauge invariant data. And the peak width is determined by T. With G equals U1, you can see this immediately. And analytically, with SU2, due to the complicated structure, you can show this for simple examples, but numerically with other examples, it turns out to be right. And what I've not talked about, but what you can immediately convince yourself, is that the Ehrenfest properties for gauge invariant observables follows immediately, simply because the complexifier coherent states satisfy the Ehrenfest properties for operators at all. So these the Ehrenfest properties for the gauge invariant ones follows from the Ehrenfest properties from the complexifier coherent states. Okay, for G equals SU2, as I said, the states labeled by degenerate gauge orbits have a qualitatively different peak profile. They're still peaked, but peaked differently, which is, I think, a bit of a fun fact, but it's nice to see. It could also have been expected from the outset, since the gauge invariant phase space is no manifold at these points, as I've already turned out. They correspond to, as well as A, as well as E being equal to zero, which is a very, very degenerate point, even for a general relativity phase space. And yeah, well, the conclusion is that the gauge invariant coherent states are useful for addressing some classical issues in the gauge invariant sector. So these states basically can, on a gauge invariant level, do everything that the complexifier coherent states can do on the kinematical level. All right, the outlook, of course, Tina has already mentioned it, is now after the gauge invariant coherent states obtain the diffeomorphism invariant coherent states, which will be much more difficult, I think. And particularly one could ask, should one take the image of the gauge invariant coherent states under the diffeomorphism invariant rigging map? So this would be one solution. And, as I said, this is work in progress. And with these states, one could hope to approximate, for instance, the graph changing master constraint, which can be written down on HDIF. And, this would then gather some insight on, say, dynamics of the system, which would be really nice. Okay, thanks for your attention. First of all, yes, it's true. I mean, in the diffeomorphism This basically, these degenerate points basically come from the fact that the gauge orbits don't have the same dimension everywhere, and this also happens for the diffeomorphism gauge orbits, right? I mean, if you have a graph that has absolutely no symmetries, then its gauge orbit is somehow different from a graph that has a high internal symmetry. Yes, one should probably expect a similar thing to happen, but of course this is elusive so far. But it would be the natural derivation of that, exactly.